This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio, here on NPR One.
I'm Dale Sequist. I'm 87 years old, and I lived here all my life, except for when I was away at school and when I was in the Army.
When were you in the Army?
It was after the Korean War and before Vietnam. I never did anything heroic. I played trumpet all over the country for Uncle Sam.
Let's go back in time and tell us about your family. When did your family come?
About 150 years ago or so. Grandfather got very perturbed with the religious oppression in Sweden.
What was the religious oppression? What was going on?
I could tell you a story about what happened. My grandfather was what they call in Swedish a fina snickare. That's a fine carpenter. He made cabinets and things like that. And he had gone to a neighboring village to get the measurements for some cabinets he was going to build. While he was away, the local sheriff and the local pastor came and forcibly took the children, three of them, away from grandma and took them against her wishes and baptized the kids. And when grandpa came home and heard about this, it made him disgusted. Of course, it didn't help any that they sent him a bill for their services.
Was this Lutheran or Catholic?
It was Lutheran. And grandpa thought that baptism was fine, but that the kids should get to the age where they understood it and knew, and they were just young children and didn't understand this a bit. All they knew was that they got wet and that it wasn't fun. It irritated Grandpa a lot that they would do something like that. He said, I'm going to go to America where I'm free to worship as I please, and I don't have to worship if I don't want to. I don't know exactly why he wound up in Marinette and Menominee, across the lake from us here. He got a job in a lumber mill over there. It took him, I think it was 3 years, to earn enough money to saving every penny he could to send for Grandma and the children. When they came, they lived in Marinette, which is from here about 18 miles or so away, across the Lake Michigan, across the Bay of Green Bay. And then they moved to Ephraim, which is about 5 miles south of us here. And when they got there, they built a cabin in the woods. I don't really understand how a lot of these people that came over here, how they survived, because where did they live when it rained? I mean, you can camp out in the woods and have fun doing it, but when you're trying to build a house with a few tools and trying to survive, you know, they had deer to shoot, so they got meat. But a lot of the families that came over here from different countries, they faced similar problems. And I really wonder a lot of times how those people survived. My story is parallel with an awful lot of people that had the same problems, same situations as what my ancestors faced. Well, they gradually moved north. The way they got property was to cut the timber on the property and deliver it to the Ephraim dock. And by cutting the timber, they got the property. So they owned a piece of property in the Ephraim, and there's still a hole in the ground up there where their cabin used to be. But as they cut more and more of the timber, they moved further and further north. Pretty soon they got down to where I live now, which is right to the west of us here. They cut the timber down there, and they'd walk back to Ephraim every night. You know, that's 6 miles from here. They'd start before the sun got up in the morning and get back after it got dark in the evening. And there was two boys, Frank and Carl. Carl became my grandfather. As boys, they worked on one end of the saw, two of them, and Grandpa walked and worked on the other end of the saw. And they cut a lot of trees that way. And
was he still alive when you were born?
No, he died in 1927. And I was born in 1933.
Is he the one that started growing apples and cherries?
Well, when he got to Ephraim, he did like Johnny Appleseed said he should, and he planted a few apple trees. And it didn't take him long to realize that this is really a pretty good place for raising fruit. And, of course, it's because of the close proximity to Lake Michigan here that we can raise fruit here. You see how fragile fruit is. Today we were in several orchards. Well, some of the orchards got a pretty decent crop. Some of the orchards don't have hardly any cherries because maybe a change in 1 degree of temperature from the one orchard to the next in the spring when the buds are fragile. Well, at any rate, he heard, I suppose it was about 135, 140 years ago, about some trees that were planted down near Sturgeon Bay. He made the three-day trip to Sturgeon Bay to see those trees, and he came back all enthused about the possibility of planting cherries up here in northern Door County. He managed to order, I think it was 700 trees. He paid 6 cents apiece for them. Now we pay $6 and think we got some kind of a deal, but he got his trees for 6 cents apiece. And he worked, those guys, a lot of them that were up here worked as commercial fishermen. So they tried to earn a keep here by fishing and fishing and fruit growing. And Grandpa planted those trees, and wasn't long before he couldn't harvest them by himself. His family helped, but people in the community, and there wasn't many people around here, helped him. But pretty soon the trees grew larger, and he, all of a sudden, he had a crop that he couldn't take care of. And more migrants came into the county. At its heyday, there was 730, I believe it was, cherry growers in Door County. Door County became known as Cherryland, USA.
Wasn't it the largest producer?
It was the largest producer, and we raised up to 50 million pounds of cherries here in Door County. And, of course, a lot of migrants, about 12,000 of them, would come into Door County to harvest that fruit by hand.
Where did the migrants come from?
We had people that came from all over. A lot of our folks that came year after year were Indian folks from Indian reservations. I grew up with a little Indian boy that came back every year for many years, and we became fast friends. It was just like a big family moving in. They'd live in their tents, and they'd be down near the water. We got property down by the water, and they'd put their tents up down there, and they were happier than a lark. They could swim at night and fish and pick cherries during the day. At one time, 12,000 migrants would come into Door County. To harvest up to 50 million pounds. The migrants, they came from all over. During the war, we had German war prisoners that came and harvested our fruit. And we had people from Jamaica that came and harvested. That was a great group. So those people would sing in the orchard. Oh, boy, they'd sing while they were picking cherries. It was just fun. And we had lots of colored folks that came from down in Sykeston, Missouri. They came back quite a few years, and we developed a lot of friends like that.
There were a lot of other farmers in addition to your family.
Oh, sure. There was over 700 of us.
Something collapsed.
Cherries was a big thing at that time. We shipped them all over the country. But gradually, we got more and more regulations. Really, I think the government was the biggest problem as far as fruit growers were concerned. There got to be child labor laws and so on, and these people that came and helped with us, they expected their kids to be along and help them, and the whole families would come. And pretty soon it was illegal for them to live in their tents down by the lake like they liked to do. Mm-hmm. So we had to build cabins for them to live in and so on. And of course, there was a lot of regulations about that. One thing after another. So the government pretty much killed the industry. You know, when you get too many regulations, it takes the fun out of being in business. It just killed the industry. And around 1960-something, I invented a machine. It wrapped itself around a tree like an upside-down umbrella, and the cherries would be shaken into that umbrella, and they'd go roll together. Before that, we had to carry the catching canvas through the orchard, and that was a terrible job. But this machine that I invented changed the things a lot. People came from all over the country to see that crazy old.
Dale Sequest, I could spend all afternoon with you, but I have to go.
Okay.
So we're out of
Well,
time.
You don't want to have to walk, so I can understand why you want to go.
So Dale Sequest, thank you so much for sharing. This has been great.
There's a lot of stories that we could tell you, experiences that we've had here and so on. I'll be glad to talk with you again sometime.
I look forward to it. I'm Tom Wilmer reporting from Door County, Wisconsin. Come along and join us as we visit with Chris Lautenbach at his family farm. You guys have been here, what, since the 1950s?
Yeah, the family purchased a property in 1955, and so, yeah, we've been growing cherries and apples and since then and started growing grapes in the late 1990s.
So you grew up picking grapes, picking cherries.
Yeah, it was fun. Picked a lot of pails of cherries when I was a kid.
When you were a little kid, did they do all mechanical harvesting or did they do mostly hand-picked?
When I was a kid, it was all mechanical harvesting. My dad, though, it was hand-picking when he was a youngster. Mechanical harvesters evolved over time. It started with a limb shaker where it would shake each individual limb on a tree.
Oh, interesting.
And now, as you saw, it's a machine that grabs a hold of the trunk and basically, you know, can shake it all off at once.
Here we are in Door County, Wisconsin, and going way back in time, Sequest and whatnot, 100 years ago. It started ramping up and it became the number one producer of cherries in all of America. And what was the nickname? It was Cherry.
It was Door County Cherry Land USA. Basically just Cherry Land USA.
Uh-huh.
And that was between 1920 and 1960. Door County produced upwards of 90% of the cherries in the whole country at that time.
Interesting.
And it's just a small little area here.
What happened?
So a couple of things happened. Michigan figured out on the other side of Lake Michigan that they could grow tart cherries too. They kind of oversaturated the market over there, but we don't like to blame it all on Michigan.
Right. Yeah.
The tourism industry really took off here in the 1960s up here in Door County.
Mm-hmm.
So cherries maybe weren't worth a lot back then. A lot of people kind of vacated their orchards and started building hotels, restaurants, things like that to attract the tourists. So it was kind of a combination of those things.
But they're couple holdouts, you and Sequest and a couple other U-picks, right?
Yeah,
that
there's,
are still going.
Yeah, there's probably only maybe 7 or 8 places that have cherry orchards now, and Sequest is the biggest cherry grower up here in Door County. We're one of the longest standing ones. There's Shortner's has been around for a while, a few other ones.
Your operation, it's twofold because you're very much a family destination to get out in the fields and have the whole family handpick for themselves, right?
Yeah, we offer the pick-your-own cherries. We also have pick-your-own apples in the fall. We do have the luxury with our business for people just to walk around and view the beautiful grounds that we have here. A lot of people like that.
Another dynamic, the legend of the cherry spitting contest, the seed contest. Tell us about that.
I don't remember the exact year, but it's probably close to 30 years ago. We had a contest for the Fish Creek Winter Games in February of all months where you'd see how far you could spit a cherry pit. Kind of was a gimmick to start with. Well, we still have it 30 years later. There's plenty of people that come here, and they just come here to do that. We typically have a contest during cherry season in July, and then another one in February where people compete to see who can spit the pit the farthest, different mm-hmm. age groups. The record on our property is 48 foot 2 inches.
And how about you?
I haven't participated a lot or practiced a lot at it. I'm probably one of those 15 to 20 footers, so not very good.
So it's a real art then?
Yeah, there's people with different techniques. You got people that take a running start. You can't go over the line though. The roll counts when you spit the pit. The right trajectory is the way to do it. You know, try to get it to roll a little bit.
Uh-huh. You guys have evolved over the years, like we talked about your grape production and then making wine. And I remember your dad making cherry wine.
Yes.
Are you still doing that?
Yes. We have, I believe, 12 different wines that we use our Montmorency tart cherry in some capacity. Some 100% cherry, some maybe 25% cherry. Mm-hmm. We also do have a couple of cherry wines with our Black Bing sweet cherries that we grow.
Well, that sounds good.
Yep.
But you do some straight grapes?
We do. In the mid-1990s, the University of Minnesota developed some hybrid grape varieties that were hardy enough to make it through the winter and had shorter growing periods. We can't grow grapes from California here. It's too cold.
Mm-hmm.
So these grapes have thrived up here. So 1999 was our first little vineyard that we grew. We do currently have between 10 and 11 acres, 7 different varieties of grapes. And we do have some all grape wines with the grapes grown on the property.
And then somebody told me not too long ago you all moved into doing cider. That's a hard cider?
Yeah, 2018 we started with some hard ciders. We currently have 5 different hard ciders. We have an all apple one, an all cherry one, a raspberry apple, a pear.
What's your personal favorite?
I like things a little bit on the drier side, so our hardcore apple cider is my favorite because it's semi-dry. Some mm-hmm. of the other ones are a little too sweet for me.
How about the Montmorency?
Yeah, we have a stone-cold cherry that uses the Montmorency tart mm-hmm. cherry in. It's also blended with some of our Black Bing sweet cherries.
Would you like that one?
Yeah, I do like that one. It's a very cherry flavor.
This really is ag tourism destination today, right, where families come out and you have a retail venue and some things to eat, right?
Yes. Normally, we have a lot of samples in the store. This year, we haven't done it just with the COVID thing going around. But mm-hmm. Typically, that's a big part of our business where people come and sample the fruit. They sample cherry salsa, cherry jams, everything with cherry.
What are you most proud of?
I think I'm most proud of that a lot of the family has stuck together here. Two other sisters that are part owners.
Yeah, didn't another one just walk by a few minutes ago?
Yep. Yeah. Another one that works here. Got a brother-in-law. I mean, there's just a lot of family members. We get together for the most part. Yes, there's some challenging times, but mm-hmm. I think it's the family atmosphere yeah. that makes it special for all of us.
And then I just saw your dad, Bob, drive by and just pick him up truck out in the field.
Yes.
Keep an eye on things.
Right? Yeah, he likes to be out and about in the fields and mm-hmm. Make sure everything's running smooth out here.
Well, thanks so much for sharing. Chris, if somebody wanted to learn more about your world, where would you direct them?
So our website is orchardcountry.com. We've got all our information on there. You're also able to purchase a lot of our products through there. We are open all year round here, 7 days a week for the majority of the year, close a couple of days in the winter. My name is Chris Lautenbach at Lautenbach's Orchard Country. We hope to see you sometime in the future.
I'm Tom Wilner reporting from Door County, Wisconsin. We'll see you here.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, Stitcher.com, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
My name is Roseanne Cash. I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. And if I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
Funding for Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer is provided by Hawaiian Legacy Reforestation Initiative.
Hawaiian Legacy Hardwoods and Four Seasons Resort invite you to sponsor a legacy tree and contribute to the biodiversity of Hawaii. Legacy trees can honor an individual, commemorate an event, or memorialize a loved one. Every tree dedication is a living legacy and a gift which grows grander year after year. The best time to plant a tree was 20 years ago. The second best time is now.
Seventy-five years ago, World War II ended. It was the deadliest military conflict in history, resulting in 85 million casualties. We mark the anniversary of the end of that war by celebrating the heroism of our greatest generation, those who served and those who supported their efforts at home. On September 2nd, we will commemorate the signing of the Articles of Surrender aboard the battleship Missouri Memorial at Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, a celebration of the peace that followed. Salute their service, honor their hope. Join us virtually for the events on September 2nd, 2020. For further information, go to 75thww2commemoration.org.
This, ladies and gentlemen, is the end of the Second World War.